Good morning. Nice to see everybody. We're continuing this week in our different themes, different aspects to the days that we're in right now. We're now actually find ourselves in the middle of the 9 days approaching Tisha B'Av. And what I wanted to do today was to focus more on some of the main texts of Tisha B'Av. We went from the general concept with our first class. We talked about the general concept of how the different models of how we relate to the Beit HaMikdash, how we relate to mourning the Beit HaMikdash. Last week, we spoke a little bit about the actual date of Tisha B'Av, when it begins, when it falls out, how, and the lessons we can learn from that. And what I wanted to do today, as we really our last lesson before we get to Tisha B'Av, is to talk a little bit about Eicha, and the keynote, both of which are really the main texts of the Tisha B'Av day. Obviously, there's too much for us to cover it in detail. So what I wanted to really do was to really discuss a few different themes that come up from both Eicha and the keynote. And to begin that discussion, I want to just re-highlight a theme that we've spoken about a couple of times already, which is the importance of spending time preparing specifically for Tisha B'Av and for the mourning and for the avilut of the Beit HaMikdash. In source number one, I quoted for you here, and as you see, if you look through the source sheets, you may have noticed a lot of our sources today come from Rav Soloveitchik, and that is because Rav Soloveitchik was really one of the few that I've seen that really wrote extensively about the keynote and about a lot of Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av was very much a closed day in the sense that, you know, many communities would read the keynote, we'd read these eulogies, and we'd read these poems, but we didn't always understand what they were. And Rav Soloveitchik, for many, many years, would talk about the keynote, spend a full day of Tisha B'Av analyzing them, discussing them, and he really brought out a lot of understanding and new understandings to what the keynote are all about and what Eicha is all about, in a very, very unique way that I think is very relevant to us. And therefore, much of what we're going to be doing today really comes from a lot of his writings, or at least people who transcribed many of his shiurim. So in source number one, Rav Soloveitchik highlights for us, again, a theme that we've highlighted before, but I think is very, very important, which is the importance of preparing for Tisha B'Av. And many of us, you know, Tisha B'Av is not a happy time. It's a time we kind of just want to get through. So we don't always prepare. We, you know, we have the 3 weeks and the 9 days. And says Rav Soloveitchik, what's the reason that we have the 3 weeks and the 9 days? Why is it that we have to build up in intensity? As we mentioned recently, in contrast to what regular Avelut starts very intensely and then gets lower and lower. Why is it that the mourning, the Avelut D'Yishana, the Avelut, the mourning for the Beit HaMikdash has to be prepared, has to start small and then builds up? Soloveitchik says beautifully in source number one, with Avelut Yishana, which again, for those who don't remember, Avelut Yishana refers to old Avelut, which means the Avelut for the Beit HaMikdash, as opposed to Avelut Chadasha, which literally means new Avelut, refers to personal mourning. With Avelut Yishana, there is no spontaneous reaction, meaning as opposed to Avelut Chadasha, personal mourning that a person mourns for a relative, there's this intense, visceral reaction to an event. Avelut Yishana is different. There is no spontaneous reaction. The reality of the lack of a Beit HaMikdash all these years has become normal for us. There is always an equation between reality and normality. Whatever is real is normal, and whatever is normal is real. Meaning we look at our reality and we see what we see. And what we see is our reality. And therefore, the lack of a Beit HaMikdash, it's not part of our reality. And therefore, it becomes normal to us. And we don't necessarily sense that lack. We don't automatically feel that lack. People do not look upon reality as abnormal. And so, the Avelut is much harder. There is more of a risk, more than a risk, sorry, there is a natural reality that over time, people will forget. Thus, continues Rav Soloveitchik, the mourning of Tisha B'Av has to be taught. As opposed to Avelut Chadasha, which is natural and just occurs from the sense of loss, Avelut Yishana has to be cultivated. It has to be taught. One must understand it thoroughly and be sensitive to it. We must learn how to mourn, to wail and weep for the Churban Beit HaMikdash. We have to learn how to do it. We have to build it up within ourselves. And that's why it's so important to spend these days that we're doing preparing. really creating and developing that sensitivity within us before you know, Tisha B'Av, and also on Tisha B'Av, because it's not something that's going to happen naturally. And R' Soloveitchik, based on this concept, develops two very interesting, I would say, chidushim, or new ideas regarding the nature of Tisha B'Av that are a little bit different. Number one, he points out, and this is very interesting, maybe almost counterintuitive, he points out that there is one major distinction between personal avelut, between avelut chadasha and avelut yishana, is that for avelut yishana, for the Beit HaMikdash, we have a commandment to cry. We're commanded to try to get to a place of where we're wailing. There is a concept on Tisha B'Av of crying for the loss of the Beit HaMikdash. And yet, if you look into the halachot, the laws of mourning, of personal mourning, of avelut chadasha, there's no commandment to cry. That sounds a little bit funny because, you know, crying would seem to come much more naturally to someone who has a personal loss. So why do we're commanded to rip our clothes, we're commanded to do all different types of actions during personal avilut. Why is there no commandment to cry? So suggests with Soloveitchik, the reason why there's no commandment to cry for personal avilut is because it happens naturally. You don't need to command it. It's just a person feels it no matter what. A person feels that loss. A person feels that sadness automatically. There's no need to command us to cry. When it comes to avilut yishana, when it comes to the communal avelut of the Beit HaMikdash, it's not natural. There is no visceral reaction. There is no automatic reaction. And therefore, Chazal command us to cry because what they're basically saying is you need to prepare yourselves and you need to get into a certain mode where that becomes a part of what you do. Because it doesn't happen naturally and therefore we're supposed to push ourselves to get to that stage. Another interesting chidush that Rav Soloveitchik suggests, which has to do with a big debate regarding what a person is allowed to learn on Tisha B'Av. Okay. We know that during personal avilut, when a person is in mourning for a relative, so you're not supposed to learn Torah. You're not supposed to learn Torah. One of the things you're not supposed to do, because Torah is supposed to bring us a certain amount of enjoyment, or it's meant to bring us enjoyment, and therefore it's not appropriate during avilut. And there is a parallel halacha that a person shouldn't learn Torah on Tisha B'Av as well. However, says Rav Soloveitchik, what about things that are connected to the Kino? What about Gemaras that are connected to Tisha B'Av? What about learning about the keynote? And very often learning about the keynote or learning about Eicha involves understanding, looking into the commentaries. It can involve very, very deep and maybe somewhat intense type of Torah learning. Is a person allowed to do that? So there are some poskim that say, no, you shouldn't do that. You should really be focusing. You can learn a little bit, but you shouldn't involve yourself in intense learning, even if it entails Gemara, as it might be related to Tisha B'Av. Rav Soloveitchik disagreed. And he said, not only are you allowed to learn about things connected, but you should learn about things connected to the keynote and to Eicha and to all of those things. Why? Because if we're saying that on Tisha B'Av, the avelut, the sadness needs to be cultivated, it needs to be taught, the best way to learn that, the best way for that to be taught is through learning all of these things. And therefore, Soloveitchik suggested that really the day, that it's what he called a kiyum of avelut, it's the fulfillment of avelut for a person to spend this day studying and involving himself in an analysis of the texts of Eicha and the text of Tisha B'Av and the text of the keynote in detail and in depth, because that is the best way for a person to connect to the day. And Rav Soloveitchik was well known that on the day of Tisha B'Av, he would spend all day. It started, I was never privileged to be there, but from what I understand, they would have davening in the morning. After davening, he would give an hour shir, and then starting at about 10 o'clock, he would sit down, and they would basically, he and his talmidim, his students, or whoever wanted to come, congregants, would basically start then all day until it was time to daven mincha, and then ma'ariv, and that was the kiyum, that was the fulfillment of understanding, of connecting to Tisha B'Av. Yes. It's a great question. The question was, who were some of the poskim, who were some of the rabbis who suggested that you shouldn't be learning or involving yourself intensely in too much Torah? I don't have specific names. It's a good question. My understanding is that in general, many of the simple understanding of the Shulchan Aruch and the Mishnah Berurah is a person, even the things that you can learn on Tisha B'Av, you shouldn't be learning them in depth and in detail, because the concern is doing that too much can bring a certain amount of enjoyment. And that itself might be problematic on Tisha B'Av. Sometimes you involve yourself intensely in it. It could be somewhat enjoyable. And Soloveitchik felt that, if anything, it's meant to gender something else, and therefore, or gender a certain understanding and knowledge, and therefore he encouraged it. It's a very good question. Okay, I would like to actually continue and look at source number two, where he writes this, where Soloveitchik says explicitly, sorry, I forgot that I had brought this for you, where he actually talks about why he feels the study of Torah should be done on Tisha B'Av. Furthermore, in source number two, I believe that what is indicated here is that while the study of Torah is prohibited on Tisha B'Av, the study of events that happened in Tisha B'Av is not only permitted, but is in itself a fulfillment of Avelut. Understanding what Tisha B'Av means, a retrospective re-experiencing and reliving of the events it commemorates, appreciating its meaning in Jewish history, and particularly the consequences and results of the catastrophe that struck us so many years ago that it commemorates, is identical to Kiyum Avelut. That's a fulfillment of the mourning. On Tisha B'Av, Avelut means to understand what happened. And that understanding or intellectual analysis is to be achieved, as we will see, in the light of both Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebal Peh, the written law and the oral law. Without the knowledge and understanding that come from such study, our Avelut would be lacking. Meaning we'd be missing something. We wouldn't be able to mourn if we didn't really have a clear understanding of what was. Avelut Yishana, continues Soloveitchik, the mourning resulting from the Churban Beit HaMikdash is different from Avelut Chadasha, the private mourning that follows the death of a relative. In the case of the latter, one does not have to understand in order to mourn, to weep, or to feel the loss, right? He's very beautiful pointing out that when a person experiences a personal loss, personal mourning, he doesn't need to know anything. It's automatic. It's experiential. It's much more automatic. But in the case of Avelut Yishana, one must understand it thoroughly in order to experience it. That is why we must be permitted to study the events of Tisha B'Av on that day, even though there was a general prohibition of Torah study. And therefore, if Soloveitchik was, as I said, a little bit more lenient in what he allowed on Tisha B'Av, if it was done within the context of understanding and gaining more knowledge towards Tisha B'Av and what it's about. And therefore, what I'd like for us to, this is kind of like an introduction, what I would like us to do today is to really delve a little bit more into major themes that come up in Eicha and in the keynote, because the more that we know, the more that we're able to study it and to understand it, hopefully, we'll be able to relate to it more. And as I mentioned, you know, there's a lot to do. The keynotes are long. If anyone has looked through the keynote, there's a tremendous amount to talk about. So as I said, we're only going to focus on the number of themes that come up. What I want to start with is Eicha. Okay, so Eicha is the base text for all of Tisha B'Av. The truth is that in a number of places, Rav Soloveitchik would refer to Eicha as the Torah Shebichtav, and the keynote as the Torah Shebal Peh. Now, what does that mean? I mean, in a very, very simple way, in a very simple understanding, Eicha is part of the written canon, is part of Tanakh. It's the text of Tisha B'Av, and on many levels, what the keynote are, and we'll see this a little bit, and if you read through the keynote, and I encourage you, even aside from what we're doing, to read through the keynote on your own, the keynote very often are a commentary of what Eicha is. They take many of the themes, the style of the writing, much of what it's about very much mirrors Eicha. And therefore, we start with Eicha, we'll learn a little bit about Eicha, and then from there, we're going to move on a little bit and then kind of analyze the process of what the keynote are meant to be. Eicha, actually, as Rav Soloveitchik points out, is the most authentic kina. Okay? Because what is Eicha? Eicha is Yirmiyahu, out of the simple understanding, is from Yirmiyahu HaNavi, giving his own lament. Right? Why? What's Eicha referred to as? Lamentations. What's lamentations? Well, that's what the keynote are. It's lamenting. It's a certain process of sadness and a certain process of mourning. And what Yirmiyahu is doing, what Eicha is Yirmiyahu, excuse me, doing his own lamenting. And what we're going to do is we look through Eicha. Eicha gives us a glimpse into how we're supposed to mourn. Eicha gives us a glimpse into what we're missing from in the most authentic way possible, written by one of the greatest Nevi'im, one of the greatest prophets, Yirmiyahu HaNavi. So I want to do two themes, or really deal with two themes that kind of come up from Eicha. The first one actually begins with the word Eicha. Okay. The word Eicha is the beginning, is the first word in the Megillah, and it actually is a word that repeats itself many, 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 many times throughout Megillah's Eicha, and also in the keynote as well, this word Echa. So the first question we have to ask ourselves is, well, what does the word Echa mean? Okay. Echa is an interesting word. And if you think about it from a, you know, there are some words in Hebrew that are just hard to translate into English. Echa is one of those words, okay? And I'll give an example. In order to best understand this, look at source number three. Source number three is a medrash from Echa Rabbah. It's a medrash on Echa. And the medrash quotes that there were three Nevi'im, there were three prophets that prophesied using the word Echa. And from here, I'd like us to try to, based on these three examples, come up with a working definition of Echa. Shloshim Nevi'im, we're in source number three, Nev'u Bilashon Echa. There were three prophets that prophesied using the word Echa. The Elohim, and these are they. Moshe, Yeshaya, right, the prophet of Isaiah, V'Yirmiyahu, and prophet Yirmiyahu. What Moshe Amar, Echa Esa Levadi. Okay. Moshe basically said, how can I carry these people? Okay, what was he talking about? This was after one of the sins of the Jewish people, and Moshe turns to God and basically says, I can't do this anymore. How can you expect me to carry these people? How can you expect me to, you know, to be there for them? It's just not possible. Okay, so there the context seems to be Echa means how. Okay, although that's the simple understanding. Okay, if we continue on Yeshaya again giving a prophecy about the destruction, Amar Echa Haita Lizona Kirya Ne'emana. Okay, Echa here also. Echa, let's see what it means. Haita Lizona became a prostitute, right? Someone who was this trusted and very, very precious servant has now become a prostitute, right? That basically people have kind of lost their way. Okay, so Echa there again. What exactly we have to understand what that means? Does it mean how, or it could mean why? Okay, there's a few different definitions. And then Yirmiyahu here in the beginning of Echa, and beginning of our Echa, Echa Yashva Badad. Echa means something. Echa Yashva Badad. The person is sitting alone. So we have three different contexts of the word Echa. Anyone have any kind of suggestion? It's not so simple because the word seems to be used differently in different contexts. Can anyone think of a working definition of what Echa might be? Yes. Excellent. Okay. And to maybe even strengthen it might even be why. Yeah. Why? Meaning, okay. Anyone else have any other thoughts? I think that seems to be the simplest understanding. Meaning if you put the three of them together, how is often the simple translation, but it's not just like how, we're not practically asking how did it happen, we're rhetorically asking how did it happen. How could this have occurred, or almost why would you allow this to occur, God? I think that seems to be the context, yes. True, although I think that if you look at the context and the full, the question was that the word why or how in the rhetorical sense doesn't necessarily fit into the first example of Moshe, although there I do think it also is. Meaning, was Moshe really asking practically how can I carry them? Or was he asking God, and this might have to do with what was Moshe's ultimate objection, like how am I supposed to do this, God, in a rhetorical sense? I cannot carry them, which might be, again, another way of saying it. Again, you're right. Why would you do this to me, God, almost? Like, or how could you expect this of me? You're right. Okay, and it is interesting to know, by the way, that God doesn't even necessarily respond to that. So that's why that fits into what you're saying, which means, doesn't really respond to that comment of Moshe, which might indicate what you're saying, that it was really a statement but I do think that if you look at what Moshe is basically saying, which is almost the words behind the words is almost seems to be a question of why. Like, why'd you do this to me? How could you expect this of me, kind of God? And I think that the question why seems to be the simplest understanding, which means if we were to summarize what basically we're doing in one word, what we're doing on Tisha B'Av is you're basically turning to God and saying, why? Why'd you let this happen? Why did this happen? Why all this tragedy? Why all this sadness? Why all this destruction? The problem is that usually we're not allowed to do that. Meaning, if you look at the common Jewish response to tragedy, and unfortunately we've had our fair share of tragedies recently, in the last few months and certainly in the last year, while the normal human reaction might be to ask why, the Jewish reaction is almost never to say why. Never to ask why. We never turn to God and say, God, why did this tragedy happen? God, why did this tragedy happen? Why did you allow this to happen? In fact, Rav Soloveitchik is famous for suggesting that when a person, when tragedy occurs in Judaism, we don't ask lama, we ask lima. Right? We don't ask why, we ask for what. Meaning it's not about why did you, normally when tragedy strikes in Judaism, we don't ask, well, God, why did you allow this person to pass away? Why did you allow this tragedy? Usually our first reaction needs to be, what is God trying to tell us? Lima, for what? And that is the typical Jewish reaction where we basically try to move it from, we're never going to know. We're never going to know why God does anything. But what we try to do is, what can we learn from it? What does God want from us? How? What? As opposed to why, we say what? What does God want us to learn? Yet, on Tisha, there's one night of the year, there's one day of the year where we are allowed to ask why, says Rav Soloveitchik. And that is Tisha B'Av night. That is the only night of the year, the only day of the year that we're allowed to ask why. Whereas normally in tragedy, we don't. When it comes to the Beit HaMikdash, when it comes to the reality of what we're facing and what we're mourning, this is the one day of the year where Eicha is the defining word with which we turn to God. If you look at source number 4 of Soloveitchik, really explains this beautifully. Eicha means, says Rav Soloveitchik, how or why? How is it possible? What you suggested. How could you have done it? Why did you do it? I don't understand. But this raises a very serious question. What right do we have to say keynote, to ask and to complain? Normally, the rule is to the contrary. We're not allowed to ask such questions. On any other day, if God forbid disaster strikes, the law is that a Jew cannot ask Eicha. Why? The very question of Eicha is intolerable. Who am I? I'm sorry, there's some typos because I had typed up this the text, so I have a few typos here. Who am I to ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to explain anything to me? What do you mean how or why? Who are you to understand? Right? We don't usually have the right to do that. We say, we don't understand God. What allows you to be so bold? What right do you have to address yourself to HaKadosh Baruch Hu this way? When tragedy strikes, usually we say Tziduk Hadin, right? The commandment is, when tragedy strikes, what's the first thing we say when someone passes away? Baruch Dayan HaEmet. What does Baruch Dayan HaEmet mean? We're recognizing right away that God is the true judge. God is the judge of truth, or the true judge, depending on how you want to interpret it. But the point being that we recognize that we don't understand everything, and God oversees everything. He acknowledges the justness of the decree of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We never find the question of Eicha in the ordinary course of events. The catastrophe of the Churban Beit HaMikdash is the one exception to this rule. Indeed, we say things in the keynote that we have no right to say as a matter of course. But on Tisha B'Av, we are permitted to do something forbidden to us in ordinary circumstances. The Jew is given special permission on Tisha B'Av to ask Eicha. Tisha B'Av, the Churban Beit HaMikdash, enjoys a special license. If we are indeed mourning for the destruction of Jerusalem and the Churban Beit HaMikdash, we have a right to say Eicha, to ask why. But then continues Rav Soloveitchik with something really very beautiful. Why? Meaning, okay, so we're saying that Tisha B'Av and mourning the Beit HaMikdash is different. But why is today different? Why are we allowed to do something today that is prohibited to us every other day of the year? Says Rav Soloveitchik, our right to ask on Tisha B'Av comes from the precedent set for us by Jeremiah, by Yirmiyah. Yirmiyah is the one who did it. A special license is granted Knesset Yisrael that allows them to ask Eicha on Tisha B'Av because Yirmiyah wrote a book in the biblical canon that begins with the word Eicha. Sefer Eicha is not the introduction to the keynote. It is keynote, meaning it's the first real, authentic kina. In fact, Sefer Eicha is known not as Megillat Eicha, meaning in Gemara, in Torah Shebaal Peh, it's not usually referred to as Megillat Eicha. It's usually referred to as Megillat Kinot, or Sefer Kinot. The first Sefer HaKinot was Eicha. And so says Rav Soloveitchik, only because Yirmiyahu himself on this day shouts Eicha, that is what enables us to then continue with the keynote. And in fact, Rav Soloveitchik then points out that this has practical ramifications, meaning that he says this Megillah, if this is what Eicha is meant to do, that this, what he calls it in halachic terms, the Megillah, the fact that Yirmiyahu started by shouting Eicha to God, that is the matir, that is what permits us to also do the same thing. And therefore, says Rav Soloveitchik, The first thing we need to do on Tisha B'Av night, what's the first thing we do on Tisha B'Av night after Maariv? We read Megillas Eicha. Now, that's unusual from a halachic perspective. Megillah is usually not read at night. The only Megillah that's read at night is Megillas Esther, that's also read the next day. And that's because there's a special mitzvah to read Megillas Esther. But all the other Megillahs, Rut, Shir HaShirim, Koheles, which are read, which are minhagim, more than anything else, we never read them at night. We only read them during the day. Why? And usually read them later in the day. Why Eicha is there? Is it different? So says Soloveitchik, because in order for us to be able to do the rest of, what we want to do on Tisha B'Av, which is to read the keynote and to lament and to ask that question of why to God, we need to first read the Megillah. The Megillah, reading the Megillah and reading Yirmiyahu's words and tapping into Yirmiyahu's words, that is what allows us halachically to then after that ask the question ourselves. So we need to first read Megillas Eicha immediately after Maariv. We don't start with one of our keynote. We start right after Maariv with Eicha, and then we read keynote that night and the next day, because reading Eicha is the matir, is what permits us, is what enables us to ask our own questions and to continue with the keynote ourselves. And therefore, we have to start with Eicha before we do anything else right after Maariv. And Sefer Soloveitchik, that also shows that Megillas Eicha is different than the role that the Megillot, other types of Megillot plays. Megillah, Kohelet, and Shir HaShirim, and Rut, we read them because thematically they're connected to the day. You know, Rut is connected to Shavuot in a number of different ways, and Shir HaShirim is connected to, maybe connected to Shir HaYam, is connected to Kriyat Yam Suf, it's connected to the special relationship that God and Am Yisrael developed through leaving Egypt, okay? And why do we read Kohelet on Sukkis? There's a number of different thematic ways connected to maybe, because Kohelet talks about how everything is nothing, all materialism is nothing, and the Sukkah represents that same concept as well, but we leave our home and we go into our Sukkah. And so there are thematic connections, but Eicha plays much more of a role on Tisha B'Av than all those other Megillot play on their respective days. Eicha is a crucial aspect of what Tisha B'Av is. We need Eicha to be able to mourn and be able to learn about and to be able to process everything else we want to process on Tisha B'Av. Yes. Sonia made a wonderful suggestion that Eicha becomes the verbalization of our feelings, if I understood it correctly. That we're feeling this sadness and this mourning, and Eicha is how we express that verbally. I think that's a wonderful point. I would take it a step further and say that Eicha is the first way that we do that, and the rest of the keynote are meant to do that as well. And in fact, by the way, if you read through it, many of us might connect even more to the keynote than they would to some of the words in Eicha. But Eicha is the beginning of that process. Correct, 100%. Meaning, what enables us to properly express the things we want to express on Tisha B'Av has to start with Eicha. Has to start with Yirmiyahu expressing those things and us tapping into that and understanding it and relating to it. And then, once we've done the more authentic way of doing it by reading Megillat Eicha, we then can move on to the keynote, which are a more recent type of way of connecting. And of course, certainly it also represents, you know, all the way from Rabbi Elazar HaKalir all the way to more modern keynote, which are the more, I would say, contemporary texts to relating to Tisha B'Av. But I think it's a very, very, very good point. And so what we see here, ladies and gentlemen, is that what happens on Tisha B'Av, the mourning for the Beit HaMikdash breaks rules. Usually we have rules to how we relate to tragedy. Usually we have rules to how we relate to things that happen in our lives. Throughout the year, when something happens, tragedy strikes, we always, of course, we're sad, but we don't question. We don't turn to God and say why. We try to use it as a way to, because we recognize that we're never going to know why. And we instead turn to try to be practical and try to learn from it. And yet one day a year, specifically the morning of the Beit HaMikdash, enables us to break all those rules. It enables us to break all the standard ways of communication and instead turn to God and ask those things that we normally don't allow ourselves to ask. It's kind of like, the way I'm envisioning it, is kind of like, you know, when somebody's in crisis, when somebody's in a tremendous personal pain, you allow them, they might say things that normally you wouldn't allow them to say in normal conversation. Okay, you'd say, oh, you know, this person's in pain. They're not really thinking what they're saying. They're in a certain state that they need to be able to verbalize things in a way that they normally wouldn't verbalize in a normal society. So the same thing is here. Normally we don't ask this question of God. Normally we don't turn to God and say why. But yet on Tisha B'Av, we're allowed to. And on Tisha B'Av, we're almost encouraged to, because one day of the year, we allow ourselves to turn to God in that moment of intense, or what should hopefully be intense, sadness, and turn to God and say why. Almost like this helpless feeling of, God, how could you do this? Yes. Beautiful. So that, so you're saying, whereas by personal mourning, in personal mourning, what Sonia is saying is that when it comes to personal mourning, that question of why is somewhat automatic. Whereas when it comes to the communal mourning, we have to work that up to get to that point. I agree. I agree with what you're saying. I think it's another way of kind of what we saw at the very, very beginning from Rav Soloveitchik, that, you know, the emotional state of mourning, the emotional intensity is automatic in personal grief. Whereas in the communal grief, it needs to be taught. It needs to be learned. It needs to be cultivated. The only thing that I would respond is that while it's natural and normal for a person to ask why, even in personal mourning, we try not to focus on that. We try, even though it's a natural thing to do, we try at least religiously to get to a point where we can accept it, although I admittedly it's not an easy thing to do, but we try to get to that point. The goal is to try to not let that why envelop us. Whereas on Tisha B'Av, we do allow that to happen. We allow that to happen. Now you're right, we have to work harder to develop it. We have to work harder to cultivate feeling that way. But we also allow it to take place. One day a year, we break down those normal rules and allow that to happen. And then, of course, the question becomes: well, then, what's the response? Meaning, we turn to God and we say Eicha, and this is just one small point that I want to make, which is a relatively famous idea, which you might have heard before, which is God does have, according to Chazal, there is a certain type of response that God has to our Eicha, and that is a play on the words Eicha, and that is the word Ayeka. For that, we have to see source number 5 is a relatively well-known midrash, or at least the idea behind the midrash is relatively well-known, where the midrash in Eicha connects the Eicha of Tisha B'Av, the Eicha of Yirmiyah, to a word that has the same letters, Aleph, Yud, Kaf, He, all the way in Sefer Bereshit, where the word isn't Eicha, but the word is God turning to Adam and saying, Ayeka, where are you? Rabbi Avo, it's verse number 5, Rabbi Avo patach, vehema, Rabbi Avo opened up with the following idea, vehema ke'adam avru brit. The people as a whole, they violated my covenant. They violated my covenant with them. Now, Rabbi Avo is going to talk about how there were two times where a covenant was violated. One was Adam HaRishon. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Adam HaRishon hichnasti oto leGan Eden. I brought him to Gan Eden. Vitziv, and I commanded him not to do something. Ve'avar al tzivoy, and he violated my commandment, right? What did God tell Adam not to do? Not to eat from the tree. And he violated that commandment. Vidanti oto begerushin uvishiluchin. And I kicked him out. Vikonanti alav ayeka. And I basically, I lamented about him with the word ayeka. Part of that process was God turning to Adam HaRishon and basically saying, where are you? Now, in the context of that story, it was a practical question of where are you? And many of the Mefarshim ask, why would God ask that question? God knows where Adam HaRishon is. So there's a number of answers that are given. But it's also some kind of a lament where God, it could be that the Ayeka wasn't just meant to be like, where are you, Adam, practically, but where are you, Adam, meaning what have you done? Like, where are you in this relationship? Av Banav, we're on the third line, continues the Medrash. Av Banav, the same thing happened with his children, with Adam's children. Hichnasti otam le'eretz Yisrael. I brought them into Eretz Yisrael. Sheneemar v'avi etchem el Eretz Karmel. I bring you to the land of the Karmel. Vitzivitim. And I commanded them to keep the mitzvot. Sheneemar tzavet b'nei Yisrael. I commanded them to keep everything. V'avru al tzivoy. And they violated my commandments. Sheneemar v'kol Yisrael avru et Torah Techa, that everyone violated the Torah. Vidanti otam begerushin, and I judge them that they should be kicked out. Shene'emar mi beiti agar shem, from my house I will kick them out. Vidanti otam beshiluchin, I also judge that they should be sent away. Shene'emar shalach me'al panai v'yetzeyu. Vikonanti alehem, and I also lamented about them. Echa yashva badad. Look how they're sitting alone. And so this medrash draws a clear comparison between Echa, the word Echa, where, why, or how, or and the word Ayeka, where are you? Now, it doesn't really necessarily talk about the clear how they're so related. Rav Soloveitchik and many others have made the suggestion that perhaps we can suggest that Ayeka is the response, is God's response to our Echa. We turn to God and we say, why? How could you do this? And God's response is, Ayeka, where are you? Meaning, you're blaming it on me, says God. You have to first ask yourself, where are you? Where are you in this process? Where are you in your relationship with God? Where are you in everything, in the entire totality of the Jewish people and Jewish history. And you have to first ask, look at yourselves, says God. Look at where you are in life, religiously overall. And then we can start to have that conversation. You're asking me why, and I'm responding to you, where are you? Why have you not come back to me? Why are you not coming close to me? And that's as it were, says Rav Soloveitchik, is God's response to Eicha, which is Ayeka, where are you? Where are you in this? Where have you gone? And why are you no longer with me? And that's understanding number one to Ayeka. But there's another interpretation to the word Eicha. And I think that might even connect more to, I'm sorry, remind me your name?
Simon.
To Simon's thought about how the word Eicha, what Eicha meant with Moshe Rabbeinu. And that is, if you look in the art scroll Kinos, okay, the art scroll Kinos, I highly suggest if you have a copy, the wonderful translation and a great commentary at the very, very beginning. In the art scroll Kinos, Eicha is not translated as why or how. Eicha is translated as alas. Very good, David. Alas. What does alas mean? Alas just means like whoa, oy vey. Thank you, oy vey. Exactly. You can't really translate oy vey, right? It's not a question of why are you doing this, God. It's not a question of how are you doing this, God. It's just more a krechts, as they say, right? It's just more this like, okay? Now, that very much, I think, what Simon was saying before ties into what Moshe was saying. What was Moshe saying when he said, Eicha Salavadi, how can I carry these people? He wasn't really asking for an answer. He was just being like, Hashem, really? Like, I can't do this. Okay? And you could also suggest that that's what the other terminologies. Eicha Yashvar Bada doesn't just mean how or why. It just means, whoa, look at her. She's sitting all by herself. Like, oy. Oy vey, how could this be? Now, this translation of Eicha gives us a different understanding to what's going on here. It's not as much about asking the theological question as much as it's a recognition that you just don't even know how to say the words. It's almost as if somebody someone tries to explain themselves, explain an experience or explain a pain, explain something that they're going through. And at some point they just be like, ugh, I can't even describe it. Like I don't even have the words to really explain to you how I'm feeling. And that seems to be another way of understanding Eicha. Eicha is just like, I'm trying to explain this pain and I'm trying to explain the intense mourning that we're going through. And I can't even do that. I don't even have the words. I don't even have the words to do so. And it's like, you could almost envision Yirmiyahu like standing on the mountain and like trying to, get out the words, and he just can't. And he just starts with just like, Eicha. And then at some point the words come to him, but that Eicha, which is repeated throughout the keynote, is this expression of like, I just can't. Like I can't, like a cry. I can't even fully describe to you what I'm feeling. It's just so intense, so emotional, so hard to capture my experience in words. And that's what the Eicha is really highlighting. Only once he lets out that scream, it says, then Yirmiyahu begins to verbalize it, but then throughout constantly gets back to that, I can't. This idea of not finding the words, this concept of just, the pain and the intensity of the mourning being beyond words is also expressed in another major theme that we find in Eicha and also throughout the keynote. And that is the concept of the Aleph Bet. If you look throughout Eicha, most of the prakim of Eicha, and you find this in the keynote as well, many of them, again, modeled after Eicha, the psukim go in the order of the Aleph Bet. Pasuk Aleph starts with Aleph, and Pasuk Bet starts with Bet. Gimel Dalet. And in fact, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, in source number 6, notes this. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, mipnei ma laku be'Aleph Bet. Why were Am Yisrael punished with Aleph Bet? Why were they punished with this destruction that is captured with the words Aleph Bet in Eicha? Mipnesha of Ru al HaTorah Shenifna be'Aleph Bet, because they violated the Torah, which itself was given using the Hebrew language of the Aleph. It was given through the Aleph Bet, through the words of the Aleph. That's the expression. That's how we relate to the Torah. That's how the Torah expresses itself to us. And because we violated the Torah, therefore we were punished using the same way, this expression of the Aleph Bet. And in the introduction to the art scroll keynote, they talk about this and discuss this point in a very, very beautiful way that I wanted to share with you, which I think, again, highlights the same idea. The use of an alphabetical sequence, right? We also see, by the way, this happens not just when we're talking about pain. It's also used to praise God. Ashrei, Ashrei Yishev Yitech is a famous one, where we praise God using all the Aleph except for one letter, which is a different issue. Eshet Chayil is written in the Aleph bit. Why? Because the praising is meant to be throughout and total, a total expression, as they're going to say right now. The use of an alphabetical sequence to praise God or to describe a person or a concept denotes totality and perfection. For example, the passage of Eshet Chayil describes in 22 alphabetically arranged verses the entire range of the woman's virtues in following the ways of the Torah, the very Torah that was translated into human expression by means of these same 22 letters. In a less happy use, alphabetic acrostics are employed to symbolize totality of destruction and transgression in order to indicate that God's full fury was unleashed against the people of Israel. So this understanding is basically saying that the Aleph Bet it shows completion, shows totality. And there are times where we use it to show totality or completion in praising, and other times we use it to show totality of destruction. And using Aleph Bet here, one of the other themes of Eicha is to show that that totality of Am Yisrael was total and complete. But another way of saying this, and I think it's a similar way to saying the idea, is not just that it was total or complete, was that it couldn't be expressed, because Aleph Bet represents an expression, it represents speech. What we're basically saying is this exact idea that by having things written in the Aleph Bet, it's expressing the same idea that Yirmiyahu couldn't find the words. He could go from all the way from the Aleph all the way to the Taf and try to find those words, but ultimately he wasn't able to find the proper words to express the pain that he was feeling. So this word Eicha as alas or oy, together with the theme of Aleph Bet, really captures this second idea that what Yirmiyahu is trying to show in Eicha is that no matter what words you use, he couldn't properly express the pain that he was experiencing and the pain that he was witnessing. Similar to when we go through our own personal pain and we don't have the words to describe it. It's too much. Yirmiyahu was experiencing that in the same way in Megillas Eicha, in this Megillah of Kinot, and that is highlighted by both the word Eicha and the usage of the Aleph Bet. Yes. But wait, almost like the word, there were no words. Yafet. Thank you. So Simon beautifully points out that that this theme of the words not being able to, not having what to express brings to memory the sign of when Moshe came down from Har Sinai carrying the Luchot, carrying the two tablets. And according to Chazal, according to the Medrash, when he witnessed, the words flew off of the tablet, and the tablets then became so heavy that Moshe dropped them. Now, what exactly that means, we don't fully know, but what Simon is suggesting beautifully is it could be that the words left the tablet was symbolic of the idea that there was no way to properly express the disappointment and the anger and the frustration of what Moshe was feeling at that time. And that might be the symbolism of the words flying off the tablets. Beautiful. Yes. Yes, Sonia is pointing out beautifully as well that on the other end of the spectrum is the famous Hasidic story. I believe it's a Hasidic story of a boy who doesn't know that he doesn't know Hebrew, and all he knows is the Aleph Bet, and he basically sits there on Yom Kippur or whatever it is, and he basically just says the Aleph Bet and davens that God should take the Aleph Bet and form them into the proper words. And that's beautiful, yafet. That what it's highlighting is that Aleph Bet is our mode of expression. Aleph Bet is our mode of how we relate to the world around us and how we relate to God. Okay. And what we're seeing here is a certain inability to do that during certain moments of intense mourning, intense sadness. And that's kind of captured by the Aleph Bet. And also, at least according to the second explanation, by the word Eicha. What I wanted to do now, after highlighting those two themes, what we'd say was really two themes within Eicha so far. Number one was two understandings of the word Eicha. One was the Eicha meaning why, and how on Tisha B'Av it's the first time we're allowed to ask that question of why. We're allowed to ask this, turn to God and say why, which is something we don't normally ask. And then the second understanding of Eicha is not necessarily a question, but more a statement, a krechts. And basically highlighting the fact that we're without words, and on a day like this, there's so much to mourn for, we can't properly mourn it, which is also highlighted by the Aleph Bet structure of Eicha. What I want to do now is also do a little bit to go through the keynote. And what I want to do is not, again, not go into the specific keynote. We don't have time for that. And we certainly wouldn't have time for that anyway. But to really go through what I think is the important structure of the keynote. You know, another example of this would be when a person learns Torah. You learn the Chamishei Chumshei Torah, the five books of the Torah. There's two ways to learn Torah. And they're both true. They're both important. One is to look at specific stories and psukim and analyze them one by one within themselves and understand them. And the other thing is to look at them as a structure, is to look at the Torah as like kind of like the forest and the trees, as Mary, okay? Another classic example would be the Haggadah, okay? It's very common when people Pesach night study the Haggadah or beforehand study the Haggadah, they focus on the small nuances of specific texts of the Haggadah. Whereas another important thing you need to do is look at the Haggadah as a whole. Why is the Haggadah structured in the way that it is? What are Chazal trying to do? Because the structure was intentional. The structure of the Torah is intentional. What does God want, and why does he structure it in the way that he does? I think we have to ask that same question when it comes to the keynote. Most conversations and most learning about the keynote focus on the specific kina, the words in each kina. What does this mean? And that's important. Don't get me wrong. That's important and that's powerful. But what I think is also important to do is to see the overall structure of the keynote. Chazal developed the keynote and structured the keynote in a specific way with a specific goal in mind. And there are themes that are come out if we try to really look through that. And that's what I wanted to do now for the remaining time that we have, was really look through the rest of the, really look through the keynote overall and see the major themes of what Chazal is trying to do. And through that, hopefully it'll help us connect to them as we say them on Tisha B'Av. Well, one thing I want to do is the following. If you look at the back of your sheets also, the last sheet you have, and I don't think I have it for myself as well, but you can, it's just, I left it as a reference, is basically just from the Art Scroll keynote, the list of the keynote. This is just to help, what I want to do now, as I said, I'm not going to go through each one, but see the major themes. And as I do that a little bit quickly, I wanted you to have that frame of reference where you can see what keynote we're talking to. So how did the keynote start? So the keynote generally start with the more authentic. We start with Echa. And then after that, the first few keynote are really laments about the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Because again, that's the main theme of the day. And even though we're going to expand our discussions to other themes throughout the day, it certainly starts with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. There are some that it's written in a very poetic way. And again, it requires a lot of study and understanding to understand the words. But the main theme is the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. So there's even some points where other themes come up, such as other things that happened on Tisha B'Av, the sin of the spies and things like that. But the first bunch of keynotes really focus on the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Now, within this group of keynotes, there are two major themes that seem to come out. One is describing the horrors themselves, very, very graphic descriptions of the pain and the things that people did and the things that people had to do to save themselves and to help themselves, and even the things that they did that weren't appropriate because of the pain that they were in. And the other theme that's very often comes out in these first keynote are themes where we're basically lamenting the fact that we're blaming ourselves. Meaning, one part is lamenting the reality and the other part is blaming ourselves and saying this is because we're far from God. And what that really is doing is it's really highlighting two aspects of Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av really has two aspects according to Rav Soloveitchik. One is it's a Yom Avilut, it's a day of mourning, where we basically lament and say, God, how could you do this? How could you do this? But it's also, says Rav Soloveitchik, a Yom Ta'anit, it's a fast day, right? As we've noted, isn't in classic personal mourning, a person doesn't fast. What is fasting meant to do? Classic fast day is meant to spur tshuva. It's meant to spur us to improve ourselves. And so the first bunch of keynotes are wavering back and forth between these two themes. One is, oh God, how could you do this? Oh God, how could you do this? Oh God, how could you do this? And then the other theme is, we're so bad. Chatanu, ashamnu, baganu, is a recognition that there is our, and it could be by going back and forth, it's also mirroring the human experience, right? We don't always just go from one and say we're horrible. Very often the human experience just jumps back and forth. It's your fault. I'm sorry, I did it. It's your fault. I'm sorry. And that's kind of what's happening in the first bunch of keynote, the first number of keynote, where we're basically lamenting the destruction while also recognizing and talking about our own actions led to that destruction. Beginning with keynote 21, Chaf Aleph, we now kind of shift. And that's the keynote about the 10 martyrs, the 10 Asara Haruge Malchut. There's a little bit of a shift. At this point in time, we now are not just talking about the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. We're now talking about the destruction of Jewish communities over the course of history. Okay? It's no longer just about the Beit HaMikdash. We're now shifting and going to talk more about tragedies, for example, like the Crusades, or talking about the expulsion of certain communities in Spain, or the ten martyrs. If you look at, I think because of time, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to go through this in detail. But if you look at source number 8, Rav Soloveitchik points out that this is very much in line with what Tisha B'Av is meant to be about. Tisha B'Av is not simply the mourning for the Beit HaMikdash. It is also a mourning of all the tragedies that have happened and the mourning of communities. And says Rav Soloveitchik, the mourning of communities is itself a tragedy almost on the level of the Beit HaMikdash, because we're mourning what was, we're mourning everything that has happened. And I encourage you, if you have some time, I'm sorry, we're not going to have time to do it right now, to look through that, to look through source number 8. Then at Kina 23, things shift again. In Kina 23, we're no longer talking about communal, we're now talking about a famous story of a brother and sister, the children of the Kohen Rabbi Yishmael, who find themselves, they were separated at birth and later find themselves together in a room and that ultimately recognize themselves. Now, Rav Soloveitchik points out that this is unusual because this is not a communal tragedy anymore. This is now a personal tragedy. This is a personal tragedy. It's a personal story between two people. Why are we mentioning this now on Tisha B'Av? What does the personal story have to do with Tisha B'Av? Says Rav Soloveitchik, this is now in source number 9. Again, I encourage you to read it. I'm sorry, we don't have time to read it now. He says that shows us that on Tisha B'Av, we don't just care about communal tragedy. We care about the tragedy of every single individual in Klal Yisrael. A personal tragedy is just as important as a communal tragedy. And therefore, this is highlighted by the fact that we're no longer just talking about Tisha B'Av and the communal tragedies. We're also talking about the personal tragedies. Then Chazal, and just to, the Rav Soloveitchik then points out that with Kina 36, which is a little bit later, we then shift gears again. We now, starting with the kina of Tzion, Halo Tishali, there's a number of kina that now refer, don't just talk about the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, they talk about the beauty of the Beit HaMikdash. Now, those of you who have been with us in our previous year will recognize that as not Zecher Lechorban, but rather Zecher LeMikdash. And says Rav Soloveitchik, this completes another aspect of what we're supposed to do on Tisha B'Av. We're not just mourning the destruction, we're also going to celebrate and talk about the beauty of what was. Why? Because the more we understand the beauty of what was, the more we understand the beauty of the Beit HaMikdash, the more we can then mourn and truly mourn the destruction of Beit HaMikdash. And so the reason why we spend those next 7 or 8 keynotes, Tzion Halo Tishali, describing the beauty of Tzion, it's to help us realize that the destruction of Beit HaMikdash wasn't just a destruction of something, but was a destruction of something beautiful. And then finally, later on, soon after that, we get to the more modern keynote about different communities, about the Shoah, where we then bring it much more contemporary. And we end, and with this I'll end as well, with the kina of Eli Tzion. Eli Tzion, why do we end with Eli Tzion? Says Rav Soloveitchik. We end with Eli Tzion because Eli Tzion very much brings us back to the beginning. What's Eli Tzion? Cry Tzion. It's Eicha. Everything we've said, all that we've done, and all the different things that we've done throughout this day, we end with, all we can end with is crying. No matter what we've said, it hasn't been enough. There's always more to say. We can always end with that Eicha, with that krecht, with that elitzion, which is what we're supposed to do to properly commemorate the destruction of Beit HaMikdash. And with that, our mourning comes full circle, and we recognize that as much as we've mourned, there's always more that we can be mourning. And hopefully this discussion will enhance our Tisha B'Av moving forward. Next week, we're going to do one more on this series. We're going to talk about Nechama, the concept of Shabbat Nachamu. And then after that, until my father returns, I'll pick up with Parsha.